Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of June. Last week, the Supreme Court ordered California to cut its prison population by 30,000, saying conditions in the state's overcrowded prisons are so bad they violate the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. According to the New York Times, all 33 state prisons are over capacity and half of them are over 180% capacity. The U.S. Department of Justice report published in 2006 shows that 7.2 million people were at that time in prison on parole or on probation. That means one in every 32 Americans are held by the justice system. The incarceration rate in this country is the highest in the world. Joining us this hour to talk about the California case and also to look at the issue of prisons, who is in prison, and whether or not there is great racial disparity, which she will say there is indeed. Professor Michelle Alexander is on the staff, the College of Law at the Ohio State University. She holds a joint appointment with the Moritz College of Law and the Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. She's also was a member of the Stanford Law School faculty, where she served as director of the Civil Rights Clinic. She has litigated civil rights cases in private practice, and she has served as director of the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU of Northern California, which spearheaded a national campaign against racial profiling by law enforcement. She's a graduate of Stanford Law School. She clerked for Justice Harry Blackmun on the United States Supreme Court and also for Chief Judge Abner Mikva on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit Court. She has written for The Nation, most recently on the California cruel and unusual prisons, and she is also author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And thank you very much, Professor Alexander, for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I realize, and we're at fault on this too, that it has been a long, long time since we've devoted a full hour to prisons in this country and in the state of Wisconsin. It's an issue that we have just let go by the wayside, haven't we?
Yes. Well, certainly the media is not alone in that respect. You know, people who are locked in prisons are out of sight, out of mind, and the population that cycles in and out of prison are politically powerless folks who often live on the margins and have little voice. So it's easy for us, all of us, to turn a blind eye, but I'm encouraged that there seems to be a bit of an awakening going on, and that more attention is finally being paid to those who have been forgotten for so long.
How many people in prisons now are there on nonviolent offenses?
Well, the majority, over 60%.
Over 60, wow.
Yes, percent of people who are in prison. But actually, even that number overstates the percentage of people who have been convicted of violent crimes in the system, because that's just people who are behind bars. And of course, as you mentioned at the top of the show, most people who are under correctional control are not in prison. There's 2.3 million people in prison, but 7.5 million people under correctional control. So the overwhelming majority of people who are under correctional control are not in prison at all. And the overwhelming majority of them are non-violent offenders. Violent offenders typically get prison sentences and longer prison sentences than non-violent offenders. So the overwhelming majority of people who have been cycling in and out of our prison system and under correctional control are convicted of relatively minor non-violent offenses, including drug possession. Or here in the state of Ohio, where I am, you can get a felony for back payment and child support. You know, there is a misperception, I think, in the public at large that those who are kind of labeled felons and or criminals are kind of the most dangerous types of folks. You know, they're sensationalized in the media or in Law and Order, and that's just not the case. They are poor folks, generally struggling to survive, and particularly poor folks of color who are targeted at grossly disproportionate rates, particularly for drug crimes.
So there has been a good deal of fear-mongering and a good deal of race baiting?
Absolutely, yes. you know, really, if you kind of go back to see where this era of mass incarceration began, it began as a result of politics, particularly racial politics. Our prison population has exploded, quintupled, not doubled or tripled, quintupled, in a 30-year period of time for reasons that have stunningly little to do with crime or crime rates. Over the past few decades, crime rates have fluctuated, have gone up, have gone down, and today, as bad as crime is in many parts of the country, crime rates are at historical lows. But incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have consistently soared. Most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates have soared regardless of whether crime is going up or down in any given community or the nation as a whole. So what explains the prison boom, if not crime rates? Well, the answer is the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, the wave of punitiveness that washed over the United States at the outset of the Reagan Revolution.
You wrote in a recent piece in the New York Times, and this is a pretty dramatic statement, if our nation were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people behind bars. 1 million people employed by the system, criminal justice system, could lose their jobs. Private prison companies could see their profits vanish.
Yes, that's, you know, I think people just don't have a sense of how the scale of our prison system and how astonishing prison explosion has been. I mean, yes, to get back to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, we'd have to release 4 out of 5 people, 4 out of 5 people who are in behind bars today. This system is now so deeply entrenched in our political, economic, and social structure. So many people's jobs depend on it. Small towns have kind of their entire economic base now dependent on prisons. This prison system is now so deeply entrenched that it's not going to just fade away as a result of the current economic crisis. We will see likely some modest prison downsizing, but we're not going to go back to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, a time, by the way, when many civil rights advocates thought that rates of incarceration were egregiously high. We're not going to even go back to those bad old days without some kind of major shift in public consciousness, a major upheaval in favor of education, not incarceration, jobs, not jails.
Why is it that the Supreme Court just now is deciding to make a stand when we have had mass incarceration for quite a few years now?
Well, yes, the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, as I describe in my book, The New Jim Crow, in some detail, the U.S. Supreme Court has aided and abetted mass incarceration since the war on drugs was first declared. But, you know, I think that we saw last week that, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 margin, not overwhelmingly, but by a narrow margin, finally came to see that the severe overcrowding that exists in California literally shocks the conscience and does constitute cruel and unusual punishment. And to be clear, this isn't just overcrowding where you have, you know, inmates kind of stacked up in cells and in gymnasiums. No, actually, this overcrowding so severe that inmates, it was uncontested, that inmates were dying every week because of inability to access medical care. The system had become so unmanageable that people were dying on a weekly basis because of the severe overcrowding. Now, if this were happening anywhere else in the world, we would be looking at that country in shock and horror. At the, you know, incredible human rights violations that were going on as a matter of routine. But the conditions here in the United States, right, you know, there in California, were scarcely getting even any media coverage. And so it was the fact that mass incarceration was literally causing people to die. Now, I think it's important to bear in mind that there's nothing in this opinion that precludes the escalation of incarceration in the United States, provided that states can afford to build more prisons. You know, Justice Kennedy even specifically, you know, the court specifically acknowledged that the problem in California is that because of its budget crisis, the state can't afford to build more prisons. And so the overcrowding has become so severe, and the state's been unable to provide just minimum level of health care services to the people they are caging. And that is what caused the U.S. Supreme Court to conclude that the Eighth Amendment was violated. But as soon as California can afford to build more prisons, it can continue to escalate its rate of incarceration.
What will they do in the meantime? Will they send prisoners out of state?
Well, you know, California is right now exploring a number of options. I mean, the court actually ordered a relatively small number of inmates to be released to ease the overcrowding. I think, you know, it's roughly around 40,000 inmates, which is a large number, but given the size of California's prison system, it was a relatively modest number of folks who can be released. And many people in the media, particularly in California, reacted with alarm, as though now the hordes are going to be coming home and thousands of criminals who are going to be returning to communities. But, of course, these are folks who are coming home anyway. The average prison stay in California is about 54 months, and the actual time served is just over 40 months. So many of the folks who will be coming home early will be coming home early by weeks or months, not years. There is some indication from Governor Brown in California that perhaps they wouldn't have to release anyone. Perhaps they could find a way to absorb the excess prison population in the jail population and essentially overcrowd their jails instead of their state prisons, which are under the court order. I hope that is not the route they go and that they do, in fact, send people home. After all, many of the people who will be released early are people who would not have even served time at all a few decades ago. I mean, today people are serving years in prison for minor offenses, including minor, drug possession offenses, crimes for which they, may have served days or a week in jail, or maybe have just gotten probation a few decades ago.
Justice Scalia, in his dissent of this opinion, is quoted as saying those prisoners, in regard to those prisoners who will be released, most of them will not be prisoners with medical conditions or severe mental illness, and many will undoubtedly be fine physical specimens who have developed intimidating muscles pumping iron in the prison gym. He said the prisoners to be released are just 46,000 happy-go-lucky felons fortunate enough to be selected.
Yes. Well, the mocking tone of Scalia's dissent, I think, indicates the utter, disregard for the fact that these are people, human beings. These are parents. These are fathers, mothers, somebody's son, someone's daughter, members of communities who, again, are not kind of the demons that, the media often, portrays them to be. They may be people who are suffering from drug addiction. They may be people who are desperately poor and pass bad checks. They are people who are often very desperate and who have violated the law or made mistakes in their lives. But to characterize them as in these kind of, stereotypical, in a caricature-like fashion, in such a mocking way, I think, really indicates the distance that still must be traveled if we are going to cultivate a more compassionate public consensus that turns away from this race to incarcerate.
Interestingly, today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has a front page story on some votes that were taken by a Republican committee. As you know, we've become a very conservative state. And Republicans, this will probably be part of our budget, would include ending early release for prisoners as part of the budget to be passed in Wisconsin. Early release was passed by Democratic lawmakers as part of the 2009 through 11 budget in an attempt to find savings and help solve a massive budget deficit. From October 2009 through April 26 of this year, 526 prisoners were given early release. 29 have returned to prison for committing a new crime or having their parole revoked. Is this what is happening still in states that have become Republican? I've also read that there are some states, because of their budget concerns, that are really looking carefully at early release and trying to find out ways to lessen the prison budget.
Yes, there are a number of states, Ohio included, that are looking at early release and ending harsh mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenders and other kind of nonviolent offenders as a way of shaving millions of dollars off of their prison budgets. We've reached a point now where states, gripped by fiscal crises simply can no longer afford to maintain this massive prison state without raising taxes on the middle class. And, many states, whether they're, run by Republicans or Democrats, are going to have to face the reality that the numbers just no longer add up and that it will be impossible to provide basic services, public education, paving roads, et cetera, without making some kind of cuts in the prison state.
You mentioned lower crime rates. There are those who would be in favor of what I just outlined by saying that because we did build so many prisons in the 90s and in the 80s, that's the reason that the crime rate has been lower.
Yes, well, that's highly exaggerated. In fact, mainstream criminologists today estimate that the amount of crime reduction that can conceivably be attributed to mass incarceration ranges from around 3 to 25%. So even assuming that 25% of the crime reduction, that has been achieved in recent years is in fact attributable to mass incarceration, that still means that the overwhelming majority of incarceration has had no impact on crime whatsoever. And there are a growing number of sociologists today who believe that far from reducing crime, we have now long since passed the tipping point where mass incarceration is actually causing far more crime than it conceivably prevents. Now, how is that the case? Well, it's because mass incarceration hasn't affected all communities in the United States. We use the term mass incarceration, which sort of implies that this is a phenomenon that's affecting everyone. But in reality, mass incarceration has affected a relatively small slice of the American population. But within that slice, they've come for nearly everyone. It was reported several years ago that in Washington, D.C., 4 out of 5 young black men and nearly all those in the poorest neighborhoods could expect to serve time in prison. Rates of incarceration, nearly as shocking, can be found in other poor communities of color across America. Now, when you begin to lock up majorities of the men in poor communities of color and brand them criminals and brand them felons, and then discriminate against them legally for the rest of their lives in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits, effectively locking them out of the mainstream society and legal economy, you are destabilizing the most vulnerable communities and ensuring that the majority of those who wind up in prison will cycle in and out of prison for the rest of their lives. And this way, mass incarceration causes poverty, destabilizes communities, and can contribute to or create the very problems of crime that it claims to want to prevent. And, you know, in so many poor communities of color across America, you see the devastation caused by the war on drugs. In fact, in the Chicago area, the majority of working-age African-American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives.
Ooh, that's a dramatic statement as well. We welcome phone calls. Professor Michelle Alexander is our guest. She is at the College of Law and also the Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. She is a professor, a dual appointment, and author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, starting with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. 10 years ago, I would have totally, wholeheartedly agreed with the professor. I am a person who was on most issues considerably left of center, except due to some financial reverses and various things, I spent a good deal of the last decade living in very bad neighborhoods where the majority of the population is of color. And I saw people just within my own block. I'm not talking about my neighborhood. I'm talking about my block. I saw homicides. I saw... I was a victim of burglaries, assaults. I saw husbands beating wives, mothers beating children, vandalism. I saw criminality on a very high level. And I saw police coming in and taking away people in handcuffs quite a bit of the time. And I never ever saw anyone taking away in handcuffs where I thought to myself, gee, this person really didn't do anything that much, you know? And my sense is that, yes, there is a huge racial disparity in prison, but I don't think it's because the system is racist so much. I think, for example, O.J. Simpson proved that if you have money, it doesn't matter what color you are in the criminal justice system. The trouble with most minority people is that they do not have the money to hire good lawyers. As far as I'm concerned, the problem with American society is that we maybe don't incarcerate enough white people, and that we ought to, instead of in worrying about that we're incarcerating too many people, we should instead address the issue of why are we producing so many people who behave in criminal ways.
Professor Alexander.
Well, certainly I'm not arguing. I don't think anyone's arguing that crime isn't a serious problem in many poor communities of color. What I think creates the kinds of dynamics that he's describing and he witnessed is in poor communities of color, what you have is the concentration of severe poverty, where very few people in the community have access to education, have jobs, have not been in the system. You have situations where the majority of, like I mentioned earlier, that the majority of people have been branded criminals and felons and thus are legally discriminated against in employment, can't get jobs in the legal economy, do not have access even often to public housing because you can be barred from public housing when you have a criminal record, that there are so many layers of disadvantage, and the disadvantage is concentrated geographically in a small place that results in higher levels of crime and dysfunction in those communities. And that's not to, none of this is to say that those problems aren't real. They are real. The question is, how best do we respond? And interestingly, in the 1970s, at a time when no one could possibly even imagine that our prison population would quintuple. Back in the 1970s, mainstream criminologists were arguing that we should begin to think about dealing with crime in some means other than prisons. They found that prisons actually cause more crime than they prevent, that they are nothing more than kind of training schools for future criminals, that the worst possible thing you could do is to take, a young person who is a nonviolent offender, maybe caught with a little weed in his pocket or, got into a fight or a brawl, and put him in a prison filled with nothing but people who have also committed crimes, some of which far more serious than the initial nonviolent or relatively minor offense that, landed them in prison, and that people who come out of prison wind up far much worse off than when they came, and that the odds of them reoffending went up if they spent time in prison, did not decline. And so back in the 1970s, mainstream criminologists were predicting that prisons as an institution would likely fade away, at least for the majority of people who were being incarcerated at that time, because they concluded prisons failed. But instead of heeding the advice of the experts and all of the available evidence and the research that had been conducted that time, a political movement, not one based in evidence or science, but a political movement, a Get Tough movement, was launched, a movement that had relatively little to do with actual concern about crime or drug abuse or drug addiction, and nearly everything to do with racial politics. Numerous historians and political scientists have now documented that the war on drugs was part of a grand political strategy known as the Southern Strategy, of using racially coded get tough political appeals on issues of crime and welfare to appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who are anxious about, resentful of, threatened by many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. Now, to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge that poor and working class whites really had their world rocked by the civil rights movement. Wealthy whites could send their kids to private schools, give their kids all the advantages wealth had to offer, but it was poor and working class whites who were faced with a social demotion. It was their kids who might be bused across town to a school they thought was inferior. It was their kids and themselves who were forced to compete on equal terms for scarce jobs with this whole new group of people they had been taught to believe were inferior to them. And this state of affairs created an enormous amount of anxiety and fear and resentment, and also an enormous political opportunity. Pollsters and political strategists found that thinly veiled promises to get tough on them, a group of people not so subtly defined as black and brown, enormously successful in persuading poor and working class whites in the South to defect from the Democratic New Deal coalition and join the Republican Party in droves. In the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, he said, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they did.
Yeah. Considering the fact that the great increase in the prison population since the 1970s has been for nonviolent crimes and relatively minor drug offenses, possession in many cases, not sale of drugs. And African Americans are more likely to get prison sentences for drug offenses than white offenders, even though studies show that they are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. It is hard for me to believe that the Supreme Court decision doesn't go beyond overcrowding and look at this whole issue. It's been with us for such a long period of time. How can our society live with that? That is obvious racial disparity.
Well, the Supreme Court has been very happy to live with the obvious racial disparity for a long time now, and I don't think anything in last week's Supreme Court decision signals a willingness to take more seriously claims of racial bias in the criminal justice system. You know, for decades now, studies have consistently shown that people of color are not any more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. In fact, where significant differences in the data can be found, frequently indicate that white youth are actually more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth. But the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in a series of decisions, beginning with McCleskey versus Kemp and Armstrong versus United States, that it does not matter how overwhelming the statistical evidence may be or how severe the racial disparities are, that you cannot even state a claim for racial bias in the criminal justice system unless you can offer proof of conscious, intentional bias, tantamount to an admission, in order to even state a claim of race discrimination. Now, as a practical matter, these rulings immunize the criminal justice system from judicial scrutiny for racial bias. How many officers are going to say in court, well, yes, Your Honor, you know, the reason I stopped him was because he was black? Or how many prosecutors will say, you know, in open court, well, Your Honor, I would have given him a better plea deal, but he was black? I mean, law enforcement officials, like the rest of us, know better than to state our racial biases out loud. And the reality is that most of the biases and stereotypes that drive law enforcement decision-making operate on such an unconscious level that they wouldn't be able to articulate them if they tried. A law enforcement officer who sees a young black kid walking down the street with his pants sagging down may think, oh, let me stop him and question him, frisk him, see if he's got any drugs on him. That thought would never enter their mind, may never enter their mind, if they see a young white kid walking down the street in his neighborhood. That officer may well be well-intentioned, may not, you know, mean any harm to the young black man, but his unconscious biases and stereotypes cause him to respond in a way that's dramatically different than he would respond to a young white kid. And the cumulative impact of these decisions, of these individual discretionary decisions by law enforcement, is millions of folks being swept into the criminal justice system, stopped, searched, frisked, tossed on the street, often when kids are at a very young age, sending the message to them that no matter who you are or what you do one way or another, you're going to jail.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hey, hi, Kathleen. It's an excellent show. You know, I was interested in this idea of privatized prisons. I've seen this for about 30 years. I used to live in Colorado, and they had privatized, I think, two prisons in the state, and they were outsourcing Denver's prisoners to almost the Utah line, which is 250, maybe really 300 miles away from Denver, as a kind of a political sop. And those counties were not typically, if someone wanted to run for governor and he was in the state legislature, he might be able to steer some prisoners out toward those counties and get political strength and political contributions from that end of the state in exchange for, you know, sending the income of outsourced prisoners out to the various counties. And that became a somewhat of a scandal in Colorado 30 years ago. So when I hear it coming up in even a larger scale today, virtually each of the 50 states are looking at this concept, I wonder, first of all, the poorhouse laws about 100 years ago during Charles Dickens, were poorhouses were outlawed for being a form of involuntary servitude based upon some a civil crime that punishes for eternity, so to speak. And I'm wondering, with your guest, she was actually mentioning that it was tough to find statistics and proof that this is coming up in a criminal sort of way. Well, actually, I've seen there was a prison down in West Texas just 2 or 3 years ago that had been built, a privatized prison that had been built. And if she were to look for attribution on some of these bond rating pages, that they actually realized that they weren't getting the income stream, and so the bond was ready to fail. And so the bond rating agencies were looking at these privatized prisons and trying to calculate how they would be able to fill their coffers. And so if she were to look at studies of the bond rating agencies and the bond salespeople who were trying to figure ways to puff up the tenancy of the prisons in order to make their bonds float again, and it's essentially Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz and whatnot were not started as death camps in Nazi Germany. They were started as work camps with exactly the same propaganda technique, that you take the useless bread eaters and make workers out of them, and they had to work back their debt to society. Well, by gosh, when they started rounding up too many, they just had to kill them.
Professor Alexander.
Well, you know, I think there is abundant evidence that, you know, now that it's become clear that profits can be made from caging human beings, that a whole range of corporate interests now are very much invested in the expansion of our prison system. In fact, there was a, you know, interesting NPR story that aired not too long ago reporting that a private prison company had actually drafted the Arizona, the harsh Arizona immigration law, a private prison company that believed that if the law was passed, there would be, you know, a whole new market that would open up for their prisons, and they were actually interested in building a large detention center for that would house women and children who were suspected illegal immigrants. And, you know, it's indeed the case that private prison companies have lobbied for harsh mandatory minimums and three strikes laws right along with prison guard unions because those laws represent profits for private prison companies, as well as job security for prison guard unions. So there is a range of interests now that are deeply invested in the maintenance or, you know, continued expansion of our prison system. And I think the caller is absolutely right that the logic that underlies mass incarceration is one that leads us to view large portions of our population, defined by race and class, as disposable, as literally disposable. And, you know, as you indicated earlier, we've forgotten about these folks. You know, there hasn't been much attention given for decades to the plight of the millions of people who cycle in and out of our prisons and jails today.
Professor Michelle Alexander is our guest this hour. We're talking about prisons, and our conversation is prompted by the Supreme Court decision, which took place a couple weeks ago, May 23rd. The Supreme Court handed down a 5-4 decision ordering California to release tens of thousands of inmates from its overcrowded prisons on the grounds that their living conditions, including lethally inadequate health care, were so intolerable as to be cruel and unusual punishment. Our guest is professor in the College of Law and the Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University, and is author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. More phone calls in a moment at 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program, British music critic Dorian Lynskey, who's the author of 33 Revolutions Per Minute, a history of protest songs from Billie Holiday to Green Day. We'll be listening to a lot of music as well. James Brown, Pete Seeger, Lady Gaga, Public Enemy, Nina Simone, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, U2, and others. It's really a very interesting book that looks not only at the music, but of course the music has to take into account what was happening in the country during the time of the music. So it gives us a history of America, really, for the past almost 100 years. We go back to phone calls for Professor Michelle Alexander, and let's go to Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning. Thanks a lot. Well, you've covered some of the stuff that I was wanting to bring up, especially the effect of a nonviolent offender being in prison and how likely they are to reoffend as a result of being in prison, and then the limited opportunities they have as a convicted being a convicted felon. And I also, so I guess I could add that I remember reading an editorial, well, and also in my sociology textbook, it was talking about the effectiveness of drug treatment programs instead of putting nonviolent drug offenders in jail, that it would be so much cheaper to society if we funded drug treatment programs instead of putting these people in jail.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this isn't rocket science. You know, people scratch their heads kind of wondering aloud, you know, what can we do about the problems associated with drug addiction or persistent crime in poor communities of color? But, you know, all of the available research has long indicated that investing in drug treatment is far more successful than locking people up, branding them criminals and felons, and then discriminating against them for the rest of their lives, making recovery difficult if you can't even get a job or housing, a roof over your head. Under federal law, drug offenders are deemed ineligible even for food stamps for the rest of their lives. So imagine, you know, trying to recover from a drug addiction, being released from prison, and being denied even food stamps to survive. You know, on some level, the system, you know, is just irrational in its attempt to deal with persistent problems of crime and drug addiction. You know, in fact, the available research indicates that if you control for joblessness, in fact, this was discussed in a wonderful book by William Julius Wilson called When Work Disappears, you know, describing the disappearance of work in inner city communities and urban areas due to deindustrialization and globalization. But in this book, you know, research is cited showing that if you control for joblessness, in other words, if you compare white jobless men with black jobless men, the racial disparity in violent crime disappears.
Really?
That, you know, people who have jobs are far less likely to commit violent crime, no matter what their race. But we have spent now $1 trillion on the drug war, drugs that, you know, funds that could have been used for drug treatment, for education in our most vulnerable communities, for job creation. But instead, $1 trillion has been spent locking people up and relegating them to a permanent second-class status.
Thanks, Sarah, for the call. We go to Carlton in Madison. Hi, Carlton.
Hi. Good morning. I'm calling because I'm asking about the problem of mentally ill in prisons and how that contributes to crime rates and, in particular, recidivism, as well as being a human rights issue. Part of the reason I'm calling is that Bernard Harcourt at University of Chicago has done some research on transinstitutionalization as a possible explanation for the rise in prison populations, in addition to the tough on crime and war on drugs sort of movements, whereby in the 60s, the deinstitutionalization of mental health institutions, mental hospitals and asylums, led to the reentry into the community of a large number of individuals with mental health problems, who then failed to get the treatment that they were supposed to get because the mental health system wasn't prepared to deal with them on an outpatient basis. And as a result, they were essentially shoehorned into an institution, the correction system, that was totally unprepared to deal with them. And this does have some implications in terms of racial inequality, in that there's some evidence that those institutions, although they had their share of human rights violations, which is why they were disbanded, were more racially equitable than the prison system in terms of how people were siphoned into it, as you've been discussing with regard to arrests and sort of kinks in the criminal justice system, that sort of thing. And I'll take my question off the air.
All right. Thanks, Carlton.
Yeah, Yes, I think you raise excellent point, an excellent point that often gets lost. You know, you're absolutely right that the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill was not a complete success. Many of those people were reinstitutionalized, this time through the criminal justice system, where they were less likely to receive the kind of mental health support and treatment they desperately needed. And, you know, there's a lot of research that indicates that not only do people who are mentally ill not receive the treatment that they need, but that the experience of being incarcerated, of being in prison, is so mentally traumatizing and emotionally traumatizing for many people that our system of incarceration creates mental illness in people who might not otherwise have suffered from the condition and then find themselves struggling for months, years, or even a lifetime afterwards to deal with the mental and emotional conditions that were caused by their incarceration. So in thinking about how we end mass incarceration, I think it's important for us not to repeat the mistakes that were made, you know, in the effort to deinstitutionalize people. And that means ensuring that when, as we release prisoners and as we reduce the size of our prison population, that there is adequate support in the communities to which these folks will return for them to get the mental health treatment that they need, as well as have access to jobs and housing, food, have their basic human rights met.
And who's offering leadership on that issue? Anybody?
Well, I believe there's a lot of people who are doing good work on these issues around the country, but I think that there is a lack of leadership in terms of viewing this, you know, from a holistic perspective. There's people who are working on employment rights or people who are, you know, working to deal with the problems of mentally ill prisoners or people who are released. But I think the time is long overdue for us to approach this from a movement-building perspective. How do we begin to build a movement and a new public consensus in support of helping people who are returning home from prison and shifting away from the overwhelming punitiveness to a more caring, compassionate set of interventions mm-hmm. in poor communities.
Doug and DePere, hi.
Hi. First of all, this conversation started out talking about prison system and releasing prisoners early. All of a sudden, it turns into a racial issue. And the guest, I don't know where she's getting her facts and figures, but they're nowhere near the statistical information that's available online. For example, can I ask the guest how many arrests were made in 2009? Do you know?
Not off the top of my head. I don't know the precise.
Let me tell you that there were 13,687,000 arrests made in 2000.
And where are those figures coming from, sir?
What percent of those that 13 million were black arrests? Do you know, madam?
Where are you getting your information, sir?
I don't have the statistics for 2009. So tell me how many of the 13 million.
Why don't you tell us? Why don't you tell us?
I will tell you. If you listen to your guest, Kathleen, and you know what? You need to challenge these people. But if you listen to your guest, you would think that 99.9% of them are black. And that's not true. The percentage of whites that were arrested out of that 13 million were 74% versus blacks at 22%.
Well, what about the makeup of our population as a whole?
Well,
there are more whites than blacks.
Would you deny
that there are racial problems with the people who are in prison who are arrested for minor drug offenses?
Well, let me ask you about that. You discussed having a black kid walking, and I have an intimate knowledge of this because I ran a huge business. 99% of the people were black, and I'd hear it all the time.
Uh-huh.
But you mentioned that there was a policeman looking at a black kid with his pants hanging down would be more likely to get arrested than a white kid with his pants hanging down. So what are you saying, that the police force in the United States, they're a bunch of racists?
Professor Alexander, take this on.
Yes, sir. Listen, first, nothing, I said absolutely nothing in any of my comments today to indicate that I believe 99% of the people who are arrested and incarcerated are African American. And if you read my book, The New Jim Crow, you'll see that all of the data is footnoted and cited to the Bureau of Justice Statistics and all of the available resources that exist for tracking rates of incarceration by race and ethnicity. I was describing the enormous disparities in the arrest and incarceration rates for people of color, primarily for nonviolent and drug-related offenses, and that there's no dispute that those disparities exist.
And on that,
those studies have shown for decades that people of color are not, in fact, more likely
to use
or sell illegal drugs.
And we need to end on that note because we are out of time. Professor Alexander, thank you so much. It was a most informative hour. She's professor in the College of Law and Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the show, Rhonda Fanning for on-air production.